Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Mrs. Thatcher died in 2013, and her funeral, public funeral, underlined the contentious nature of her legacy. And the legacy of somebody who'd ceased to be Prime Minister in 1990, but for whom, or for some of the critics, it was as if it was only yesterday. A state funeral in St. Paul's Cathedral, a very public site, attended most unusually by the Queen in a very public show of respect, contrasted with the vocal abuse from some circles. And this difference, I think, captured the ambiguity and the differing views held of Mrs. Thatcher during her administration and subsequently. And in part of that, this was due to her determination to present herself as a figure of historical consequence, and thus as an historical figure. And in particular, Mrs. Thatcher saw herself as somebody who was going to turn back a post-war decline in Britain, one that she felt had gathered pace from the 1960s, and that encompassed, therefore, both Labour governments in 1964 to 70 and 74 to 79, and also the Conservative government of her predecessor as party leader, Edward Heath, from 1970 to 1974. Now, she presented herself in this light, not just as a restorer trying to turn back the clock, although that argument was used about her with discussion of Victorian values, parallels with Winston Churchill, etc., etc., but instead as a radical reformer, an opponent of big government whose reforms were intended to change as much as to restore, and one might say, to change in order to restore. And indeed, on top of that, Margaret Thatcher sought to survey the terrain. Whereas Winston Churchill had focused as Prime Minister, not earlier as a Cabinet Minister, of course, on foreign policy and defence, and Mrs. Thatcher, who was by every standard hyperactive, was determined to change Britain from within. As Churchill, certainly in 1951 to 55, when he'd been a peacetime prime minister, had certainly not sought to do. And indeed, it could be argued that if you wish to discuss Britain in terms of declinism, and that is certainly a contentious view, then the Churchill peacetime years matched that definition. Her agenda, in many senses, was shaped by her response to her perception of what had happened earlier in her life, notably her upbringing as the daughter of a devout Methodist self-made grocer in small-town England, Grantham. I hope listeners in Grantham won't mind me referring to it as a small town, which was a background very much outside the usual circles of conservative privilege. Here, indeed, of course, Mrs. Thatcher had a parallel with Edward Heath, not that she would have enjoyed that, and indeed with John Major, and was as much against the sort of semi-ducal pretensions and backgrounds of Macmillan, Hume, Churchill and Eden, and indeed the sort of reprise of rather sort of second-rate, tired and slightly corrupt or very corrupt aristocratic government in the persons of Cameron and Johnson. World War II was also important to her sense. But in coming, I would say, coming from outside the circles of privilege didn't entail any obvious political trajectory, as both experiences, as I've already mentioned, were true of Heath and Major, for that matter, also of Enoch Powell, or indeed of Theresa May. A key element in all of these cases, bar Major, was a lack of clubbability. and notably of the upper class clubbability of shared assumptions and background that was true of the social elite from which the conservative leaders of the 1950s had come. And indeed, a recent television programme series has reminded us that that was also the background from which traitors such as Kim Philby came. Not that I'm implying that all members of this group were necessarily traitors. Thatcher's agenda, and even more the language with which she expressed it, challenged not only those she believed needing challenging, both within her party and outside it, but also many of those across British society who would have been comfortable with a kind of continuation of the present, or indeed what was in relative terms a managed or a poorly managed decline. Seeing herself as a radical reformer, almost, I would argue, a Joseph Chamberlain figure, Thatcher sought to, or for that matter, Robert Peel, if you want to go back, Thatcher sought to transform not only the country and its politics, but also the Conservative Party, believing that that party was necessary to the former. In her eyes, politics was a moral struggle, and doubt had to be overcome. Those who talked to her, I once spoke with her while she was Prime Minister for a very long meeting, were in no doubt that for her, politics was a moral issue, a moral struggle, and one in which there was scant room for equivocation. Indeed, it's one of the great ironies of her career that she achieved what was electoral triumph without equivocation, following up her victory in 1979 with an even clearer victory in 83, and at that point, a still impressive victory in 87, only to be faced by continual criticism from within her own party, and indeed overthrown in 1990 by a rebellion within that parliamentary party, although not won by the party members in the country with whom she remained popular. I mean, it's interesting, that contrast, and that, of course, fed a kind of mythos about being stabbed in the back. I think life's more complicated than that. It is a responsibility of a prime minister to maintain the support of their parliamentary party, as well as the cabinet and the party in the country as a whole. And Mrs. Thatcher had, as it were, pushed the support of her parliamentary party possibly further by 1990, with the prospect of another general election coming in 92, than many were comfortable with. Now, what Thatcher meant at the time was in part what she said, what she asserted, but also what was attributed to her. And I think it's fair to say that that was a moving subject, or from the point of view of critics, target. It's worth bearing in mind that until until the triumph of the 83 election, it was by no means clear that she would be anything other than a one-term prime minister. And on top of that, her parliamentary majority, while considerable, was not one that was so large once you took into account those within her own party who were her critics. So I think it's reasonable to say that it's only after the 83 election that she could think of some of the more substantive changes that might well have been, in some cases clearly were, in genesis earlier on. And on top of that, in 1984 to 85, events, contingencies in the Tate's shape, in particular of a major strike by the National Union of Mine Workers, or a portion thereof, which was quite clearly intended to overthrow the government and to overthrow the nature of parliamentary government, such a strike, as it were, sidelined the nature of and the content of her politics. And again, it's only after that that you could argue that she had the opportunity to focus anew on the situation. So I think it's fair to say that Thatcher herself meant different things at different stages. And not only were there the outside contingencies in that shape, the miners, or for that matter, the Brighton bombing, or the obviously the Falklands War earlier, but there was also the extraordinarily difficult economic crisis of the early stage of her government. Inflation rose to 21.4% in 1980. And in January 1982, unemployment rose to 3.07 million, which was unprecedented in the post-1945 period. Now, that did suggest that Thatcher was going to be overwhelmed by events, as indeed were the widespread disturbances, rioting, looting that took place in July 1981. Now, in a way, Thatcher tried then and on other occasions to reimpose her authority on events. And she did so both in terms of the views she publicly outlined, the famously, the ladies not for turning, which she is told the 1980 party conference with her typical habit of speaking in the third person, but also by cabinet reshuffles, for example, the one in September 1981 after the rioting we've talked about. But her ability to inform or control events was always circumspect. To a degree, it was highest in international affairs because of another fortuitous factor, which was her influence with Ronald Reagan, the American president from 1981 to 1989, who had a great respect for her, and the role she was able to play in a way that Churchill would have loved to have played in 1955, but the role she was able to play in helping to ease tensions between the Soviet Union and America, and therefore to play a significant role in the end of the Cold War. And indeed, that was one of her most important contributions, just as in domestic terms, so also was her role in defeating the National Union of Mine Workers. Afterwards, there was to be a lot of sentiment about the mine workers, and indeed that's continued to the present day in television programs and films such as Billy Elliot. But the reality was that the mine workers were linked to, taking money from states hostile to Britain in the in Eastern Europe. It was part of the Cold War, and indeed their bully boy and intimidatory techniques, not too different from those you were to see with the coal miners who supported the Ceausescu regime in Romania, were those of thugs. And it has to be said that although now the emphasis is on the police response as a kind of militarized alien policing, one can see this recently in the series, television series Sherwood. At the time, the flying pickets were themselves in that category. I, at that stage, from 1980 to 1995, I was employed in Durham, which was, of course, a coal mining area. And the first day of the miners' strike, the local miners burnt out the NUM coal mines, the open cast ones. These were people who were thugs. And it was very important for the nature of British democracy that Mrs. Thatcher was challenged in the 87 general election and had been challenged in the 83 one, and the Conservatives were in the end to fall in the 1997 general election, because ultimately Arthur Scargill was as much a threat to the Labour government and Labour politicians, just as the same thing is true today. If you look at trade union leaders, such as the leader of the rail workers, they are as much taking action against a future Labour government as against the current Conservative one. In hindsight, of course, what is deeply ironic is that Margaret Thatcher was to be the heroine of the Conservative right, most of which came to be very much supporters of Brexit. But Mrs. Thatcher herself wanted to stay within Europe and, as it were, fight and fight again to ensure that it didn't become a corporatist left-wing body, the EU, and she didn't see that as incompatible with a global Britain. During her career, she was in many senses able to, to square the circle. That proved impossible subsequently, and her thesis, most famously presented in her speech at the College of Europe in Bruges, her criticism of the European Union tended to be the one that was overly cited, just as Churchill's support for European federalism was overly cited. In practice, both of them had much more wide-ranging and varied diverse opinions. Anyway, over to you, Graham.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Professor Black. I want to really start with asking a question. It is considered the form now, whenever there's any discussion of Margaret Thatcher, to describe her as a divisive figure, as if other politicians aren't. What interests me particularly is the criticism that comes of her and her free spells of office from the left. It is almost to take her at her own estimation, which is to say, the left regards her as tremendously successful on her terms, which is one reason why they dislike her so strongly. But are they right? I mean, if we look at Britain today with taxation back to Clement Attlee's day and a very large role for the state and an expectation from the electorate that the state has a very large role in their lives. I mean, did on the longer view, did she win?
Well, in the longer term, is it not the case, famously was remarked, that all political careers end in failure? I mean, she certainly felt that she'd ended in failure. Her enormous upset when she had to resign, or felt she had to resign in 1990, the very bittersweet character of her last appearance as Prime Minister in the House of Commons, the shadowed years in the 1990s and 2000s, as she felt that her legacy was squandered, as she became angry with the administration of John Major, troubled by what followed under Labour, and her own health faced difficulties, increased shadows. I remember meeting her to talk to at an Andrew Roberts launch party, and she certainly wasn't the figure I'd met when she was Prime Minister, let's just put it like that. So I should imagine you could say everybody's career ends in failure. But if you mean, was she, whilst Prime Minister, somebody who was of limited consequence? No, I mean, she got her legislation through the House of Commons. She wasn't dependent on a coalition government or on some sort of agreement, formal or informal, with other political parties, as had been the case, for example, with Harold Wilson from 74 on, and was to be the case with David Cameron from 2010 to 2015, and with Theresa May for the Irish votes. And, you know, she saw off a variety of challenges, whether General Galtieri, the National Union of Miners, the terrorists of the IRA. I mean, each of them an interesting comment on the other. And I thought you know, that was a considerable achievement. And, you know, you must recall, if you, I mean, James Callaghan's probably been underrated as a political and governmental figure. I certainly argued that in my history of Britain since 45. But it has to be said that there was a sense of serious crisis in the 1970s and of serious crisis in the mid-80s. And Thatcher overcame the serious crisis in the mid-80s, including the actual attempt to kill her, whereas you could argue that all that was saved by the Heath and Wilson governments was and the Callaghan governments was the national consumption of sticking plaster.
Well, I want to ask whether you feel that the claim that, you know, she shook up and destroyed the post-war consensus is true. I mean, an alternative view, which I've put forward elsewhere, is that actually a lot of the post-war consensus, she was relatively reconciled with, parts of it supportive. And actually, it was the kind of the Wilson Heath Callaghan period that was the Britain she was trying to reshape. Would you agree with that, or do you think the post-war consensus is what she had in her sights?
Well, certainly. I mean, I've argued in my book that, as I put it, Thatcher was not the most Thatcherite. And there are many respects in which she kept going with pre-existing policies and alignments. I mean, obviously, so in international relations with NATO and the American alliance, membership of the European Union, as it became, in domestic terms, there was no real reform of the centralized and rather sclerotic NHS and social welfare system. In terms of sophology, she didn't do anything about the Irish double vote. She really sort of let Scotland and Wales sleep as issues. So yes, in many respects, she kept the pre-existing system going. But let's be fair. I mean, she had a multiplicity of problems and issues. And as you probably know, there's a very fine biography by Charles Moore. I would argue the finest political biography of recent years by a British author. And one indeed that restores the great tradition of the 19th century multi-volume political biographies. And what I would suggest is, if you read the Moore, I mean, obviously he has to present it in order to have coherence in terms of separate chapters on topics like, you know, Europe, Northern Ireland, and so on. But actually, from the point of view of any prime minister, it is the simultaneity of issues that occur every single day. And the multiple roles of prime minister. The prime minister leads for the government in the House of Commons, they chair cabinet, they run a political party, they are the head of the executive, they are also the key figure. I mean, when they are, as Britain, as it were, an international body, if you're the leader of a foreign power, you don't want really to talk to the foreign secretary when you ring or visit London. You want the prime minister. So there's a multiplicity of issues, and you could argue that there was a degree of micromanagement in some cases, and that she would have been better to have a chance to pause and to think strategically. I wouldn't disagree with that. But on the other hand, she was only in partial control of her government and political party. There were ambitious and, you could argue, seditious in political terms, party terms, political figures like Michael Heseltine out to overthrow her. So I think that all of those points are worth considering when, because one remembers she wasn't a philosopher queen, or she would have preferred the term philosopher king. She wasn't a philosopher queen able simply to deploy herself and as it were, operate on a kind of protean mass of clay, which she was shaping.
I wonder if we can turn to international affairs. Obviously, a very consequential prime minister in foreign policy, and perhaps the last British prime minister who really helped shape global foreign affairs in a way in which subsequent prime ministers like Tony Blair played more supportive roles to America, which was determining the pace of policy. Firstly, I'd just like to get your reaction to that as a suggestion. But as an additional rider, can the role that she played be really played by any British prime minister now, by which I mean the Cold War, which ended almost exactly at the same time that her premiership ended, gave Britain a centrality as the most important American ally in Western Europe, a centrality that has, at least until the invasion of Ukraine last year, been secondary for British foreign policy and Britain's place in the world. Was she the last great world leader of Britain simply because Britain, up to the end of the Cold War, was still such a significant force in world affairs?
Well, that's an excellent question. I mean, partly she was helped by her ability, partly by her skill in eliciting a response from America, which was also looking for an ally and was not happy with much of that which was on offer, classically France and Germany, whereas Reagan's successor, George H.W. Bush, was more interested in Germany than in Britain. Partly, I suspect, because the Falklands War, which after all the opponent was Argentina, not the Soviet Union, but the Falklands War showed that Britain was willing to fight. And I think that was a very important moment. Whether you like it or not, I mean, I remember I was doing research on the continent and I arrived in Austria from Italy, where I'd been working. I was going to work in Austria, and I was put up by a couple, which the wife worked for the Atomic Energy Authority headquarters there. And she said to me, surely the British aren't going to fight over the Falklands. And I said to her, the one thing I can guarantee you is they are going to fight. And I think that was quite important. And if you look now, there is a sense not just that Britain is weaker, but also a country that can't even get the M25 to work when you get a few Extinction Rebellion people there, or can't overall clearly, Marxist inclined trade union leaders. You have to really say, can it have any particular consequence at the present day? So if Thatcher had given in on the Falklands, if she'd lost to the National Union of Mine Workers, then obviously we would have been of no consequence whatsoever and in international relations. There is an important link between, domestic and foreign affairs.
Well, a last question, if I may. She's leader of the Conservative Party, but a lot of her thinking, some of her orthodoxy has echoes of Victorian liberalism. Could she be described as the last great Gladstonian in British politics?
Well, she certainly wasn't interested in the very opposite of monetarism, which Gordon Brown and then David Cameron and most recently Boris Johnson, and you could argue both Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak, though less egregiously so than Johnson, have pushed forward. So you could argue she was a figure of greater fiscal probity, yes, And you could argue that that was linked to our liberalism of the 19th century Gladstonian type. But to go back, Mrs. Thatcher meant different things in different stages of her career. So did William Gladstone, as you know. So I think one's got to be very careful. You're a professional historian who became a leading commentator as a journalist. Most journalists lack that kind of ability to understand the nuances in the labels that are used. I would add most historians don't have that ability either. And as a result, I would say one's got to be very careful of describing somebody. I do it sometimes, but you've got to be very careful of describing somebody as Churchillian, as if Churchill meant the same things at all stages of his life. Well, Mrs. Thatcher was only party leader from 1975 to 1990. She was a leader as a prime minister in a contiguous sense, so that was different to both Churchill and Gladstone. So she had fewer things to need to adapt to, but nevertheless, she did have to adapt to changing circumstances and her own differing positions within the parliamentary party, and indeed the cabinet, and indeed the public.
Yes, it's unhelpful in many ways that whoever is prime minister finds themselves being compared to some previous prime minister. But I noticed that of the prime ministers that have succeeded Margaret Thatcher after 1990, none of them have really been compared to her, or if they have, it's been unfavourably. But
Can I just say, we've had, and you know, I'm not trying to kick a man that's down, but we've had that ludicrous attempt by Boris Johnson to compare himself to Winston Churchill. So I think we have had, you know, some kind of vanitas. And I would actually say that in many respects, as I argued last week, David Cameron sought to compare himself to Tony Blair. But you're absolutely right, although one minor point. When Theresa May became prime minister and made what I thought was a very powerful, moving and perceptive speech on her first day, in some respects there were echoes of some of the themes from Margaret Thatcher's views on domestic affairs and the nature of the country.
Well, we'll be discussing Theresa May in a future podcast. The next one will be about John Major. So we will pick up the threads there. But for now, for discussing the Iron Lady, Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. And readers might be interested in my History of Britain, 1945 to Brexit, because in it I try to contextualize these political developments in terms of the changing society and economy and culture of the period. And I do think that in all our programmes, Graham and I, we're very mindful that it's not as though the background of the country is static at all.